Irreverent, entertaining, cool. You're listening to LA Talk Radio.
You're listening to The Writer's Block with Jim Christina and Bobby Bell, right here on LA Talk Radio.
It is Thursday, it's 8 o'clock. This is LA Talk Radio, and you're listening to The Writer's Block. I am Jim Christina, your host, sitting in the studio tonight with the lovely, charming Bobby Jean Bell. I know you love that. What can I say? And, of course, her husband Jim is here. Good evening, Jim. How are you? And before we get started, The Writer's Block is brought to you by Black Dog Publishing in Simi Valley, by Out West Boutique and Cultural Center in Newhall, and by Target Freight Management, Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania.
And you know, we mention Target Freight Management every show, and we mention that they have a full truckload service that's the best in the industry. But have we mentioned that TFM Truckload is the finest in the industry and gets your freight there every time, on time, at the rates you need for your transportation costs? Call today at 1-844-653-7789 and tell them you heard it on The Writer's Block, and they'll have a little something extra for you. And while we're at it, if you are an LTL shipper, you are probably looking for the best rates with the least hassle. Call Target Freight Management. Their customized transportation management system is just the ticket to getting your freight moved your way. Call Target Freight Management today at 1-888-653-1323 or go to www.targetfmi.com on the web. Call today. You won't be sorry that you did. And we thank them.
We do thank them. And tonight, if you want to call in and talk to our guest, our number here is 818-602-4929. That is 818-602-4929. And I want to take a few minutes to talk about the festival last weekend. Oh, my gosh. We had such a good time. And I want to thank all the hoodlums that were in the tent with us. Gary Williams and J.R. Sanders and Dale Jackson. Al Bringus, and I mean, just everybody.
Eric Heisner. And Bob Brill. And thank you, Bob, for the blog entry that you did just in the last couple of days. Mark Bedore, Peter Shirako.
Right.
Who else did we miss? Oh, Katie Ryan, who was with us on Sunday.
Andrea was in and out.
Andrea Kidd, who was also performing at Out West. And John Bergstrom, who entertained at Out West. We just had a ball.
We did. You know, and the bookie was absolutely thrilled.
She
got to sit there with Dale Jackson, and she and JB just went at it for all of Saturday. They just had a great time.
I have a great photo of the two of them. I haven't posted yet.
They just had a really good time. And Dale, bless his heart, sent us really, really nice email thanking.
Yeah, everybody was just having such a great time. And so if all of you that are listening, many of them have been guests on the show, we so appreciate what you did to honor the written word in the West on the weekend, and how gracious you were with everybody that came up to the counter, up to the tables.
Right.
And greeted folks. And we just had a great time.
Western
hospitality at its best.
And everybody there was successful this last weekend.
Yeah,
everybody moved some books and got to talk to a lot of folks about our writing.
And a really great festival. We had people come by to see us, Don Edwards and Joey Dillon and Sid Masters, who had performed on the Wednesday night. And we always look forward to, we can't get out very much, so we really love it when folks come by to
say
hello.
We're kind of stuck there.
Yeah, we're kind of stuck. It's fun.
It is fun. Okay, get to tonight's guest. J.B. or Jerry Hogan grew up in Fayetteville, Arkansas, moved to the Imperial Valley in Southern California in 1961. And if any of you know where the Imperial Valley is, you never want to move there. It is like it's like left hand of nowhere. Where he finished high school and attended junior college before going in the Air Force. After the military, he went back to college, receiving a Ph.D. in English from Arizona State University. For many years, he worked as a tech writer in Tucson and Boulder, Colorado, before returning to Fayetteville in 2004. Jerry is the author and published over 250 stories, poems, and four books, Living Behind Time, Losing Cotton, The Apostate and Angels in the Ozarks about baseball in Arkansas with Pennell Publishing. Currently, he is past president of Washington County Historical Society and has served as chairman of the Fayetteville Historic District Commission. He plays upright bass and East of Zion, a family band that plays acoustic American bluegrass and roots music. And man after my own heart, because being a guitar player and a banjo picker, I've been around there. And we would like to welcome Jerry right now to the writer's block. Jerry, you with us?
Hi, guys.
Here, let me give you a little applause here.
All right, Jim, we're off to a bad start. You were trashing the Imperial Valley right away.
Well, you know, I'm from San Diego, so I'm really familiar with that part of the desert.
Yeah, I do. I said, you can't be doing that. That's one of my old homes.
Well, we like to get things, you know, we like to get things off a rocky start here.
Yeah, we do.
Really fast start there. So
now I noticed.
I was going to, about my books, I should say real quick, The Apostate and the baseball book, Angels in the Ozarks, those were with Pennell Publishing, and the last four, the Living Behind Time, Losing Cotton, The Rubicon, and Fallen, are with Ogma Creative Media, just to clarify.
I didn't throw that in. I should have, and my bad.
That's okay.
Okay. But for all of your friends who are out there listening, and I know there was a couple that didn't know how to get to us, I hope they were able to pull up the website and then just go
to
listen live.
Yeah, I hope so, too. I think we got it kind of clear. You made it real clear, I think, finally in a note, so.
Well, I hope I did. Sometimes I'm not very clear. For such a descriptive writer, I give really crappy instructions.
That's okay. I went back in there, and I think I clarified it one more time.
See?
Yeah, okay, great.
My babysitter.
We follow up with each other.
We kind of have to. Now, how many of your friends know you as Jerry Bob?
Jerry Bob.
How many of your friends know you as Jerry Bob?
Oh, that's all my pals out in Tucson. Because I was one of the few Southerners out there, they decided that B on my name stood for Bob. And so there's a lot of them.
Well,
my family sometimes still calls me Jerry Bob.
Well, you Arkansas boys, you got to have those two names.
Oh, absolutely.
there's a reason.
It's a requirement.
Right. There's a reason that the toothbrush was invented in Arkansas, because if it were invented any other place, it would be toothbrush.
Exactly. Just got the one left on the side. Maybe the two on the side are left.
Now, I have a quick question. You're friends with an author that we've had on the show, J.T. Biggs.
Yes.
Yes, John Biggs is a good friend of mine.
Yeah. How did y'all meet?
We met through the Ogma Creative Media, and I had not read John's work. And I'll tell you right now, John Biggs is my favorite new author. So he's a good friend, but I'm also really, really like his work.
Well, and you have a mutual fan, because he's written several great reviews of your work as well. I love to read reviews, and he loves your work as well.
Yeah, he's been really generous, and I appreciate that very much. Yeah.
Well, you guys,
I think it's interesting, because I think we write almost exactly opposite kind of work. Maybe that's why we like it. Yeah. Each other's work so much.
Well, let me ask you, what got you into writing? What fueled your writing process?
I'll tell you, I have to go back to being a little kid, to be honest with you. My mom did me a great favor. She read to me constantly when I was a little boy. I don't even remember learning how to read. That's how much she did. And so I was writing little stories for her when I was a kid, and you guys will I love this one. And when I was in the sixth grade, me and a pal of mine who just recently passed away, we decided we were going to write novels in the sixth grade. Well, I wrote, I would guess, the worst novel ever written by a human being in the sixth grade. But I wrote it. It was a sports novel, and it was just terribly bad. I mean, beyond bad. But that's how far it goes back. And then I talked about it all through one of my service buddies tells me that I was talking about it overseas. But when I went back to school in the spring of 1970 is when I pinpointed that's exactly when I consider myself to have begun thinking of myself as a writer. I started writing poetry at that time.
Yeah, you're really diverse. Short stories, poetry. I'm surprised you haven't got music in there. Or have you written music, too?
I can't, I'm not good at, I've tried to write a few songs, but they're not very good. It's just not one of the things I can do. But, I've tried to do everything. We talked about music a little bit. I like to, when I was learning the bass, I wanted to make sure that I could play both the upright and the electric. Uh-huh. You know what I mean? I didn't want to be, I may not be have very much overall talent musically, but I wanted to make sure I wasn't limited within that realm. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's kind of the same approach I've taken to writing. I started with poetry. I think I went naturally into fiction, and then I've done pretty much all kinds of writing, you know, screenplays, historical writing, all that sort of thing.
I have a question. The Rubicon, since we're talking about poetry,
yeah,
and short fiction. Now, this was published just recently, December of last year,
right,
2015.
Yeah, exactly. Came out late last year, yeah. The Rubicon. Yeah, exactly.
And I was able to, I kind of flicked, you know, through it and tried to read a variety of pieces as I prepared for tonight. And I'm curious, can you tell us a definition of flash fiction?
Oh, yeah, sure. Well, I think that there are different ones, but the one I go with is flash fiction is anything that's like under, like, so say, 750 to 1,000 words.
Okay.
So I have a lot. The Rubicon is actually primarily a book of poetry, but we decided to kind of do the thing you're not supposed to do and put fiction in there with it. So I selected stories immediately after a poem, and except in one case, I think, they're all thematically linked to the poem in front of them, and I use quite a bit of flash fiction there, and I think it works that way better, because flash fiction and a longer poem may be, you know, kind of coming close to one another in a sense.
And I enjoyed that very much. Whenever, as I was going through, if I saw, oh, here's a fiction, because you highlight them that way. You let us know what it is we're going to be reading.
Right.
Then I made sure to go.
Surprised.
Yeah, so I made sure to go to read the poem ahead of it, you know, one or two ahead of it. And I enjoyed it very much. Now, who, do you have a favorite, you know, poets that have inspired you? Who do you look to for inspiration?
Well, I don't use the term inspiration usually, but in terms of who has influenced me, that sort of thing, perhaps, or who are my favorites, I would say that a lot of my poetry is actually influenced strongly by the beatniks, the beat poets. In particular, I look to Jack Kerouac and Lawrence Ferlinghetti. Kerouac, I learned a really good literary lesson from, as I was reading his Mexico City Blues, and I just loved it. And what I learned from Kerouac is at the end of each of his poems, he has, well, I like to do it, it'll have this sort of a sound thing. This is a pop at the end of each poem. So, you know, in any story, anything, you want to grab people, but you want to leave them with something, too. And in poetry, I think that's a nice thing, is you have a little pop there at the end of the poem, and when they leave the poem, they go, wow, what was that? And I got that from Kerouac.
Got it.
Hey, being a writer of poetry, prose, and short stories, and novels, is it hard for you to switch gears, go back and forth?
Well, probably not really, because I think I usually do them, you know, I'm in one mode or the other.
Mm-hmm.
I don't usually work the only thing I've ever done simultaneously was write a couple of screenplays at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
Usually I will focus in on a work or a type of work and just finish that and then move on to the next one. Now with poetry, I write poetry, but I don't think of myself as a real poet, but I write poetry. Is it just come? I don't know when it's going to show up. It will be an image or something like that, and then it'll just pop in, and I'll just, boom, write a poem. And that's how that works.
Uh-huh.
The fiction, I'm more usually thinking about something, you know, that I want to say or, you know, tell a story about.
Okay. That's a good answer.
And then I always like to understand or come up, you know, hear how the titles come about. So the Rubicon, tell us, still speaking about that publication, where does that name come from for that book?
Well, the Rubicon is the name of what I consider the key poem in the book. But generally speaking, all my titles come out of the book themselves. Like the title of Fallen is one of the main stories in there. But the Rubicon comes from the poem itself, and the Rubicon is the river. And you probably guys may know this, but the Rubicon is a river in Rome that the old Roman generals, you were never supposed to cross the Rubicon with your army. You stopped outside because if you did, that meant you were like in a civil war state. And Julius Caesar crossed the Rubicon when he eliminated the old Roman Republic and started the empire. And so I use that as a little thing, a little metaphor for perhaps things that have occurred in recent years, over the last few decades, that sort of thing.
Well, you know what Julius Caesar's wife said?
I'm afraid to ask.
She said, if I told him once, I told him 1,000 times. Julie, don't go.
Don't go. Don't go. It's not the right day.
Well, you know, when
tomorrow.
whenever I hear the term the Rubicon, I'm a fan of Broadway musicals, and for a long time there was a show on Broadway, 1776, and the John Adams character has a fabulous song. He has a lot of fabulous songs, but they're taken right off of his letters and from his writings. And there's a famous line in one of the songs about crossing the Rubicon. And that was the first time I'd ever heard of the Rubicon.
Yeah.
And he uses it really as a metaphor for independent, you know, that we're crossing the Rubicon.
Right. There's no going back cross the Rubicon.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. So
you can use it in its most general sense. You know, it can also obviously be used to mean there's been some sort of political overreaching in some fashion, you know what I mean, without getting into any details.
Oh, you mean like lately? Like lately?
Well, in the last few decades, I would say.
Hey, Fallen, is that some sort of autobiographical to a degree?
No, that one is not autobiographical, it is about a writer.
Right.
And it has one autobiographical element, the little thing he has on the wall, his little motto, is actually a motto I have on my refrigerator right now, which is, there's no such thing as security, no one gets out alive, there are no happy endings.
Hey.
A lot of people think that's a really dark philosophy. I think of it as realistic. But the guy that's the author, the writer in there, is a guy named Jim Finnerty. And what he does is he finds that success has a really bad downside to it. And he has to work his way back, and then we think, well, is he going to do it again, or isn't he going to do it again? So it was actually written on a dare. My late brother-in-law, who was a poet, Kirby Estes, I told him about this idea of making it big in Hollywood or New York and then degenerating really quickly. And he said, well, write that story. And I said, okay. So I did, and that's Fallen.
It's great. It's a great title.
Yeah, I like it a lot, and because it carries a lot of. I like most of my titles because I feel like they carry more weight than just the name itself. You know, like the one I always like to point out is the first book, The Apostate. I always tell everybody, if I wasn't trying to tell you something, why would I call it that and not just call it Death in the Desert? You know what I mean? I want people to go and say, if they don't know what the apostate means, go look it up. And then, you know, to me it means a person who's lost the true faith, or actually faith in humanity in this particular case.
Sure.
And then so who does it apply to in the story then, that kind of thing?
Gotcha.
You can see the old English major in me.
Well, and there was one, I think this might have been from your website, about the apostate, and to me this was like, okay, this is why I have to read this. Hijacking, kidnapping, murder, and a twist of fate. What more could you ask for? The apostate leaves you on the edge of your seat. Such intensity reads like a roller coaster ride. Fasten your seatbelt and get ready for suspense. Okay, so that's the next one I've got to get into.
Now, if we're talking, kind of, since we're kind of talking about where these stories come from, this will give, if anybody's like a new writer or something, listening or whatever, that story, which is the story of the carjacking of a burned-out English professor in Tucson, who is not me. The whole genesis of that story was that when I lived in Tucson, a lady was hijacked at El Con Mall there. And all I did was I took that carjacking and put my story on there, you know, which is, I like to say, the story is about redemption or the lack thereof.
And he's a wanted guy, too.
He is the wanted guy. Yeah. That was the fun of it.
It was a twist.
We discover along the way that, in fact, he's an escapee
right.
himself. He's,
right.
he's run from the country and run from a previous crime that he was part of. And he's got this detective who realizes who it is, who chased him then and is chasing him now.
So he doesn't want to get caught.
He does not want to get caught. Well, he doesn't even know he's... All he knows is that he's been a carjacked by a really, really nasty young guy.
Yeah, well, yeah.
Yeah, Bobby Earl is coming unglued all the way through the apostate.
See, there's that two names again.
I know. Don't
exactly.
ever trust somebody with two
because
names,
if you guys,
I guess.
I don't know if you've read it that carefully, but Bobby Earl is from Fort Smith, which is 60 miles down the road from me.
That's Isaac Parker's territory.
Yeah,
the hanging
exactly.
judge.
That's it, Judge Parker.
Hey, losing.
In fact, Judge Parker, and it's a book that hasn't come out yet. Will hopefully be next year. Since you guys are into westerns, I'm not really a cowboy, but I write westerns too, and I wrote one called a novella called The Last Rider, which I think we're going to hook together with some stories and put in a book. And the opening scene is going into Fort Smith in that very atmosphere.
Yeah, it was almost like a carnival on hanging day.
Oh man, it was a very strange thing, and sometimes they would hang several people at the
right,
same time.
Right, I think his record was 6 or 8.
Yeah, something like that. I've actually been down there, been into the old jail they had,
really?
Went out to the hanging area and stuff. And
Losing Cotton is a great premise for a book, and it's like picking up the 60s and putting it in 2015. It's 50s and 60s. I understand it's the loss of the white Southern economy.
Oh, Losing Cotton. You
Losing Cotton. Yeah.
There.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And it's
now, Losing Cotton is set in the Imperial Valley, of course.
Yeah. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But it's almost as if it was pulled right out of Mississippi.
You know? You could look at it that way,
I think.
Once again, the Losing Cotton, the term cotton in the book carries a whole bunch of different meanings.
Sure.
With it.
Sure.
Yeah. And that's the whole.
And you've got, when you sit down to write, I try to ask everybody this because I know what I do. What's your day like when you sit down to write? I assume that you are now fully retired. Is that correct?
I didn't ever retire exactly. I just stopped working.
Oh. I like it.
I want to do that.
I have enough of my own work now that whether I make any money or not, I can work full time on it, and that's been true.
Okay, well,
but
there you
go. When I do write, I'm an outliner, Jim. I do a lot of outlining.
So
I think a story through almost all the way before I get going. Sometimes I overdo it and kill a story, but that's my approach.
We've had several writers that don't work without lines. We have several that have worked without lines. We have several that have tried and failed miserably. We've got them all. So, and you're an outliner.
I have been. So I've been in recent years. I've done so much more nonfiction writing than fiction that a lot of times, even though I'm using a lot of notes. That I've got. Sometimes I just go ahead and crank those out without going to the level that I outline my fiction. It seems like it'd be the reverse of that.
Uh-huh.
But that's kind of what's happened.
Your day is like what? It starts at what? And when do you write? And when do you don't?
Yeah,
write?
my days are almost exactly the same all the time. I'm a real structured kind of guy. I usually at least 3 days a week, I'll spend the morning at my local library or the University of Arkansas library. Researching. I'm always researching local history. And then I come home and I write. And sometimes that turns into fiction and sometimes into poetry. Most of the time it comes into articles, historical articles
mm-hmm.
in recent years.
Mm-hmm. And do you, like, do this over coffee?
No, I just do it here. I'm kind of... I like to joke I live in my 21st century writer's hovel.
I think we all have one.
I have a table with notes all over the place, and I just work.
let's kind of like backpedal here a little bit and go into Angels in the Ozarks. This is like really fascinating. It's a really fascinating story. Can you tell us about this story and how did it come to be?
Yeah, that started because first of all, let me say that's nonfiction. Angels in the Ozarks. That's about an actual professional minor league, a Class D, the lowest that there used to ever be, except for briefly there was a Class E, but Class D was the lowest level, and it actually existed around here, and almost no one knew about it. So that always thrills me when I'm doing my historical work, is to find things that people don't know about. Now, I got interested in it because my family had saved an article about it, and it was real funny. They were so poor. It was during the Depression, 1934, 1940, and the teams were so poor that the Fayetteville team had been, they'd had a couple of names before, and they got some hand-me-down uniforms from Ponca City, Oklahoma, and they were the Angels, and the team at the time was called the Bears. They were so poor, they couldn't afford to take the Bears off, you know, take the Angels off and put the Bears on, so they just took the new name. And I thought that was so funny.
Repurposing.
So today we're the Bears, we got new uniforms, you're the Angels, boys.
Oh, that's great.
And they were so poor they couldn't do anything, and so that tickled me, and I wanted to research a little bit, and then I just got locked in. And you can see with all this, you can see from what you read about my bio that I'm just totally immersed in local history now, all because of that baseball that got me. So because when I was reading all the baseball, the papers about the baseball, I'm seeing all these other stories all the time, you know, that I didn't know about my hometown and the area, and so it just blossomed out.
Huh.
So like next year, I should have a book of all the articles I wrote here locally come out, a nonfiction book. So,
what can you tell us about J.B. Hogan that's not in your descriptions? It's not in your bio. This is the time for you to lie.
This is the time for you to lie, right? Make it up.
I know what I can tell you that a lot of people wouldn't know. That's just kind of a fun fact. When I was in the Air Force, in my last year and a half, I was stationed in Goldsboro, North Carolina, in the 4th Tactical Fighter Wing. I worked in headquarters. And when you remember, when the Pueblo was captured in early 68.
Oh, sure.
My entire base was shipped to Kunsan, Korea. And shortly after we got over there, we swapped our commanders, and my commander was Chuck Yeager, the guy that broke the speed of sound.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
That's kind of cool.
And my favorite Chuck Yeager story, he was Colonel Yeager then. He ended up Brigadier General. My favorite Colonel Yeager story is that we had a whole bunch of hotshots came into Kunsan one time, like 8 or 9 brigadiers and above, all generals. I was terrorized. And Colonel Yeager and his clerk served coffee to all those generals. So that's my Chuck Yeager story.
Oh, wow. That's kind of cool.
Yeah.
My dad's...
And I always tell everybody, too, he was a super nice guy, and he treated you like a human being all the time. And if you ever see him talk on TV, he speaks exactly the way he is and was.
Well, he's very, very slow speaking, isn't he?
Well, I think he's a thoughtful speaker.
Right.
He's measuring his words, but he's just who he is. You know what I'm saying? There was no artifice or pretense about Colonel Yeager that I could see. That's why everybody liked him so much.
Huh. My father's a commanding officer in Korea, and when he used to fly F-86s, was Francis Gabreski.
Oh. Where was he at? Do you remember? Did he tell you?
Kempo.
Oh, okay. That's
during the Korean War.
That up close to Seoul.
Yes.
Closer to Seoul.
Yeah. Yeah. It was during the Korean War.
Yeah. Kunsan is down the middle of the country.
Right.
Down there. You know what do they call the Korean, the Rock Tigers, the Republic of Korea? They were still flying F-86s when I was over there.
Is that? Oh, I'm sure they were. I'm sure they were. Great airplane, my dad says.
Really showed my age there.
Well, hey, my commander when I was at Fort Lewis was Norman Schwarzkopf.
Oh, whoa, Storming Norman.
Yeah.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah, great guy. Great guy.
Well, there you go, then. We've known the big famous guys.
There you go. There you go. Okay, back to your writing.
Yeah.
Tell us what you're working on. What I mean, because I've got your notes here.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
What are you working on? What are you trying to complete? What's going to be done this year, 2016?
Yeah. Well, this actually is another thing that people would know about me, probably, Jim, is that what's happening now is I'm that classy guy that when I first started getting published, I'm the guy that had the box full of manuscripts already done.
Uh-huh.
Because I'd been writing for like 35 years or so with hardly any success, and then it just started happening. So what's next on the agenda, hopefully in August, will be my next book, is a mystery novel set in the 30s called Tin Hollow. And that is actually set in a town very much like Fayetteville. and I use, not to say it's exactly, but very much like it. And I use my baseball stuff in there. So I have like a baseball player is found dead in a rough section of town, and the story is to find out what happened there.
And then you have you have Last Rider listed here. You've already spoken about
Last
that.
Last Rider, that's my Western novella, which I like to call my existential Western, because I always envision the West being really, really rough. And it could be. I mean, it could be tough on people. And so I envision this guy that, in fact, everything in the world is basically out to kill him. You know, there's just stuff happening all the time. And so he just keeps... it's actually one of my favorite characters. His name is Moses Traven. He's one of my favorite characters ever, because he's nothing like me whatsoever. He's very brave, and he just deals with stuff all the time. And anyway, so the story just follows him as the world tries to take him out.
Do they?
And he tries to stay in it. Yeah, he gets taken out in a bad way.
But he gets a little
revenge at the end too, though.
Oh, good.
Now I have,
and he's a right guy. Yes, yes, Bob.
I have a question again, especially for those that are looking to get published. You have successfully been picked up by a couple of different publishers. Can you tell us a little bit about the process that you went through to find your publishers?
Well, luckily for me, Fayetteville is like a kind of a hotbed of creativity, music, and literary and artistic, and so forth, and so. Pennell and Augment Creative are startup small presses. Now, they've both established really nice catalogs of books by now, but that's kind of how I got into it. Actually, the first book, The Apostate, is a direct result of having written some Western. Actually, The Last Rider was published in serial form in Frontier Tales, which Pennell publishes. That's their Western journal. And so that's how I got a hold of those guys. And then Ogma came after me in between books. Some of my work doesn't really fit for Pennell, and so I went ahead and signed with Ogma.
Do you have an agent?
I do not have an agent. This all happened on my own, or like, for example, I kind of went looking for the Pennells, and Ogma kind of went looking for me, is the way that worked.
I spent a little bit of time on Pennell's website. I'm not sure that I did on the other. It was very interesting. I could see a number of publications on Pennell that I knew I would want to read if I had time to read things. Other than the books by the authors that we have here.
Right. Well, they've got John Biggs has got a couple of three books over there with Pennell, and other people that I know are published with them. Yeah, they have a nice catalog. And then Ogma's building a big catalog right now, too. So I think we have two. I'd say they're both really excellent small-time publishers.
So when
small press.
When they picked up your book, then did they provide an editor for you for final editing on the publication?
Yes, the books go through an editing process, which is a tooth and nail with me oftentimes. Because I fight to keep what I've written in there as much as I can. So, but yes, that's part of the process at both publishing houses.
I'm chuckling because I do the same thing.
You wouldn't be a writer if you didn't fight for it, would you?
I know. Yeah, it's like you spend hours agonizing over the right way of putting things, and some editor comes by and wants to change it. You know?
Right.
Do you find?
Well, you have to compromise, but you don't. But you can still fight in there for
exactly.
You know, a chunk of it.
Exactly.
Tell us about. Yeah. Do you have challenges writing dialogue, or does that just flow for you?
I don't want to overstate anything, but I've always felt that my dialogue was just pretty much right on. I've always felt really comfortable with the dialogue because I hope it sounds like real people talking, because that's what I want. I want my fiction to be realistic and authentic, just as much as I can possibly make it.
Well, that's a trick in itself.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah,
I felt certainly in losing Cotton that dialogue was very right on, and comfortable and authentic, especially I specifically enjoyed the conversations between the two ladies, Carol Scott.
Oh yeah, Carol Jean and I've forgotten their names myself.
Well, there's those two names again.
Carol Scott
Marcy Cotton Claiborne and the other gal, yeah.
And Marcy, yes.
Yeah.
Well, you know, real dialogue. People talk in a pentameter, and if that's not present when you're writing dialogue in a book, it seems jerky.
Yeah.
It doesn't flow.
Yeah.
So.
Well, I just try to make it, like I said, I just want it to sound like people that I hear talk. I want it to sound exactly like we human beings speak to one another.
Yeah, and we all slur and we all use colloquialisms and.
Exactly. Yeah. So, we know. Do that sort of thing, and sometimes I overdo that, and that's one of the things that the editors have done is kind of back me off of some of that, but. Sometimes you can't, like if you're writing a Western, you can't have them talking standard 20th century English all the time.
No, you can't.
That's just not going to work.
No.
The other thing I hang my hat on in all my books, I mean, you've probably seen that, is the physical geography and the location.
Mm-hmm.
When I write a story, unless I've invented one, and even then I try to make it seem like a place that's really there, is it's actually places I know personally. Like in Living Behind Time, the trip the guy makes, I know I've either lived in or spent time in or know every single town and place that the guy goes to. So I try to make that a real strong part of my writing.
Well, there's always going to be somebody that knows it. You know, there's always going to be somebody who says, wait a minute, I know that place.
Right. Or the authenticity.
That's actually what I want to happen.
Right.
That's exactly what I want to happen, Jim. I want the person to read the book and go, hey, I'm from Brawley, California. I know exactly where that guy's talking about.
Yeah. Well, I wrote about a canyon once, Teatro del Diablo. And it's the Theater of the Devil, and it's in Chiricahua Mountains in Arizona. And
right.
And a friend of mine was reading the book. It's called, what's the name of the book? Stryker? Dark Angel.
Dark Angel.
It was in the Dark Angel, and she's reading this book, and she goes, "Hey, I know that place. I've been there."
Uh-huh.
So
exactly.
Yeah, and so you know, you got to keep on top of it because there are the ones that will catch you.
And you want them. I think that's a good thing because when I watch films or read books, that's what I want. I look for that too. I want them to be real. I want it to be real places. And also, when you do get it right and people read it, or like we do, it's kind of exciting. You go, man, I know that place.
Yeah, exactly.
I know that street, you know?
And now they've got a visual.
Exactly.
You know, they've
now
got a
grounded
true visual.
In a visual reality.
Exactly.
Well, and that's how I felt about the description of the Salton Sea, which I've only ever seen on Huell Hauser, you know, explains
right.
in California. But some of the scenes in Losing Cotton that happen around the Salton Sea, it's like, I do really want to get there.
Well, you don't want to get there anymore.
Jim's going to pass on that one.
It's kind of dying.
Yeah, the Salton Sea is dying, Jim. It's kind of unfortunate.
It used to be quite the resort back in the day.
It did.
Yeah.
You can see when, you know, because I actually didn't mean these books to be that, but most of my books have ended up being historical fiction. I didn't mean them to be. But they are that way.
That's the research, Jerry.
It is. That's exactly what it is, guy. That's exactly it.
But you know, if I could go back to Losing Cotton for a moment, because I know it's, you know, set, it starts with conversation about maybe Nixon coming to town. So we know that we're set in a different time period. And yet there were moments throughout the book where I felt that it was still very contemporary, even to our own time, some of what the characters were thinking about. And I actually wrote out a comment that Frank... Is it Mason is his last name?
Frank Mason, right.
Yeah, he thinks this to himself. It's early in the book. I made a note that it's on page 33. But if you don't mind, I'd like to just read this little sentence, a couple of sentences.
Go right ahead.
Because to me it felt like many of us today could relate to this thought that Frank, who is a young man, had. Frank wanted to say that he felt so small, so insignificant, so unsure of himself in the face of what seemed to be on the horizon for American society, that he wasn't sure what to do, or when to do it, or how. He was just a kid, and he didn't understand what was happening, But he hadn't said that. He couldn't. He didn't know how. And I think today we're hit with a lot of that. We have things we think we need to say, but we don't know what they are, and we don't know how to say them, and we know there's something big coming, but we're not really sure what it is. Right. And I really...
Bobby, first of all, thank you for reading that, because I like that passage a lot, because I think it reflected the insecurity of the time. Remember, the book is set exactly when we're... I like to say it's changing from the 50s to the 60s right at that time. Even though it's already in the 60s, the decade of the attitudes and so forth of the 50s were still there into the 60s, and right around the time of Kennedy's death is when, in that whole stretch of time that the book is set in, is exactly when we switched into the 60s mode.
Yeah.
And so this guy doesn't know quite what to do with all that yet.
Yeah, I
appreciate you doing that. It sounded really good to me. Thank you.
Yeah, well, that's when the country lost its innocence.
When yes, Kennedy that's was exactly right, Jim. That's exactly right. That's one of the points of the book, of course, too.
Hey, okay, this is the question of the day. The name of the show is The Writer's Block. Bobby's over there. She goes, I know what this question is going to be. Have you ever gotten writer's block?
Not really. Because I have such a strange writing history, I'm what I call a sporadic writer.
Uh-huh.
I will not do anything for a stretch, and then something will happen, and then I'll just burn right through the thing. And that's how I write. So the only... No, I have not really ever had that, you know, where I'm just locked up.
Uh-huh.
No, I've never had that. I've had trouble sometimes coming up with some short stories. Sometimes I kind of, I need to write something. I just couldn't come up with it. But that's not the same thing.
Uh-huh.
Now I mentioned earlier about it. Sometimes I have worked on a book too much and kind of killed it off. I just outlined it too much. I needed to have more of it be sort of natural and organic. And so I've got a couple of three books like that. But as far as just being, flat out, no, I've never had that.
Hmm.
Which is a lucky break, I think.
I can't remember the last person on here that said they'd never had writer's block.
I don't think I've ever had it in any kind of conventional sense.
Jack,
you know what I mean?
Yeah, we had a writer in here named Jack Martin, and he was in the studio with us, and we asked him the question, and he goes, no, never.
I think that was right. Was it Don? That's interesting. I always think, JB, that I really need to go back and listen to our shows and actually do a transcript of them so we could do a fun, here's the quick answers that people gave us to the writer block question.
Right.
Right. Go back and trim it down.
Yeah.
Exactly. Because I'll blab all night long. I can talk about history so long.
We have found that our writers like to talk about their books because that's what writers like to do.
And that's what we're here for.
We like to get your idea and your the way of doing things, and that's what we're here for.
And I thank you personally, and I thank you on behalf of the other writers, because I know they appreciate it. Because there's not very, very many venues for writers to get to talk about their work.
No, especially where you get pretty much the whole show to yourself.
Yeah, which is super nice of you guys. I really appreciate it.
Well, it's kind of our way of saying thank you for being our Facebook friend.
Yes, and we really appreciate you.
Because you've been a really good friend to us on Facebook. So,
I keep track of you guys, and it's fun to watch what's going on.
Well,
And I realize I know there's a Western emphasis, and I'm not really a cowboy, but I do write Westerns, because who doesn't like a Western?
It's okay. We started with Westerns because that's the circle of authors that Jim and I had the most connections to, but we certainly want this to be more encompassing and not so niche. But we'll always have some Westerners because that's really, kind of where our hearts our hearts are.
But, I read all kinds of venues, the genres I like are mysteries.
I do too.
And I like Westerns, and I like everything. I like historical stuff.
I'm having a ball reading. It's hard to keep
on top
of.
Well, you guys may like my book coming out, that Ten Hollow, then, because It's a mystery with a couple of twists.
I am going to like that.
I'll tell you what. If you send me a copy, I'll read it. I'll write a review.
And now, you know, a couple weeks ago, our guest was Ken Dunn, who is the founder of Next Century Publishing and also the social media platform Reader's Legacy. And if you've not listened to that podcast, JB, I would encourage you to do so and get yourself hooked up on Reader's Legacy. Get your books up there and do what you need to do. I think this is going to be explosive, and it's very, very exciting. Just even in the last couple of weeks, they've made some changes again on this website, and this is absolutely going to go places, and it's phenomenal for authors.
Right.
What he's offering will be offering.
Thank you, Bobby.
Yeah, so we really want to help get the word out to our authors and readers to get hooked up with Reader's Legacy. And then was it .net or .com?
No, it's .com.
.com. Readerslegacy.com and Next Century Publishing. They published 1,000 books last year in their first year out.
Whoa.
Yeah, the guy is phenomenal. He's an ex-homicide detective from Ontario.
Yeah, and when the night we talked with him, he was on his way from Boston to Philadelphia to address 1,000 authors the next day at some type of a conference or a convention or something. This is absolutely so exciting. You need to get in on it.
Thank you so much. That's a wonderful lead. I'll try to listen to that tomorrow even.
Yeah, okay. I've actually got all my books up there now.
Yeah, I know Bob Brill told me he got all of his up.
Yeah. Yeah, it's really good. It's a really good thing.
As you guys know, that's the hard thing for small presses is to get, to break out.
Right.
It's really hard to get even regional is hard, but national is really hard.
Yeah,
well, this is going to go places. He says his goal is that Reader's Legacy be to Goodreads what Facebook was to MySpace.
Right.
And he has a vision, and he's excited, and he's got the funding. He's got 65 staff, all with cutting-edge technology backgrounds, avid readers, and this is going to go places. It's just getting started.
Yeah, he spent, $3 million
Of his own getting it going.
Together,
and
yeah.
He's going to be unveiling, he's got different things happening, coming up. So you're going to continually see, so listen to the podcast because he also shared some of what will be available that's not there yet. It was very exciting. Very exciting.
Hey, the time we've got left, Jerry, and the time we've got left, why don't you tell our listeners where they can get a hold of you and email address and et cetera, et cetera?
Right. You can email me at jbhogan22@hotmail.com. On Facebook, I have a Jerry Hogan page, but my author's page is JB Hogan on Facebook. I have both of those. And my work is available at Amazon, of course, from Pennell and from Augma Media.
Right.
And soon, readerslegacy.com.
Yeah. I'll be checking that one right away, that's for sure.
Hey, I want to thank you for coming and visiting with us tonight. It's been great.
Man, you guys are so nice. I appreciate it very much. This is a real great thing. I really appreciate the work you do and the help you give authors. Thanks a lot.
Well, thank you so much. And we'll be I've got a mug in my office all boxed up and ready to send to you. So you're getting a writer's block coffee mug.
And I'll post the podcast link on our Facebook page and on your page as soon as I get home.
Right. And it's going to be available as soon as we walk out of the building and climb down the four-story stairs.
We'll be listening to it on the way home.
I'll try to get that out tomorrow then. I'll send that. I have my big list of contacts. I'll send it to everybody.
Oh, do that.
That's great.
And thanks again for coming in and seeing us.
Thank you.
I appreciate you very much. Thank you.
Let's talk again soon.
Keep writing.
Okay.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye, JB.
Bye-bye.
JB Hogan.
That was really fun. I want to read everything.
I know, huh?
I have to finish Losing Cotton because I only got halfway through, and I really want to know what happens.
You can only read so much, and that's the deal.
I know, because I work.
next week we have John Hagenberger back on with us.
And I'm excited to read some things of
his 1959 Private Eye and Stan Wade.
Yeah.
And it's great. His stories are just marvelous.
And he's been another great fan. We appreciate his posts on our Facebook page as well, sharing the word.
He has. And he's really, really, really a good friend of the Writer's Block page. So, and I see we had to crawl up 4 flights of stairs to get here tonight.
Know.
Oh my gosh.
Boy, am I old and out of shape. Oh, yeah. Oh my gosh.
It's gonna be easier going down.
Yeah, well, gravity will take us there. I mean, we all came in the door, hit the lobby, and fell.
In other words, the elevator is not working at LA Talk Radio for the next few weeks. So
it.
We'll be coming in breathless each week.
And they couldn't be on the bottom floor. No,
of course not.
They got to be on the fourth floor.
Yeah.
So thanks for joining us tonight. It's been fun, Bobby. Always
yes.
a pleasure.
Always a pleasure.
Thanks again also for the Buckaroo Bookshop. Oh my gosh,
so much fun.
So much fun. Jim, always good pleasure seeing you. And we are out of here for tonight.